Science's War on Religion, Exploding the 7 Most Common Religion-Bashing Myths. Historian of Science exposes the false stories of Neil deGrasse Tyson, Bill Nye, the Science Guy, Stephen Hawking, and others. That's our topic for this portion of Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and our guest is Dr. Michael Newton Keys, who is a lecturer at Biola University. He's a senior fellow at Discovery Institute and has a PhD in the history of science from the University of Oklahoma. Dr. Keys, great to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me on the show, Jerry.
Okay, sure. Now, you have a book, I understand, Unbelievable, 7 Myths About History, the History and Future of Science and Religion. Tell us about that book, and then when you're finished with that, I want to really focus on the Christian origins of science, which is a kind of an untold story, although we should be shouting it from the rooftops.
Yeah. So I've taught astronomy and biology and their history for about a quarter century to college students, and I kept running across these stories that made Christianity look like anti-science. And these stories are recycled by Bill Nye and others, like you mentioned. But when you dig into the facts, you find out that these stories themselves are myths, and that's the big word myth in my book, 7 myths. And I cover 7 of the most pernicious of these myths. And once you remove the myth, there is actually a positive story that's left, and that's how what you would describe as the Christian roots of modern science. So my book also gets into that.
Oh, that's so cool. Well, we are kindred spirits here because D. James Kennedy and I wrote a book many years ago, in fact, 25 years ago, called What If Jesus Had Never Been Born? And one of the chapters in there is called Thinking God's Thoughts After Him. And it's about the Christian origins of modern science. And this is a story that is not known. But before we get into that, let's go ahead and, you know, rip away some of the major myths. What do you see as one of the most pernicious myths about Christianity supposedly being at odds with science?
Yeah, there's the common idea that a big universe is a problem for Christianity, and that modern science discovered that the universe was huge after centuries of people thinking the universe was really, really small, and that this debunked religion, particularly theistic religion. But it turns out if you just look at even Old Testament poetry, like in the Psalms, it's very clear that the psalmist knew the universe was huge, and it was a picture of God's greatness. There's a bunch of psalms that are like this. And when you get to the early modern period with Copernicus and Kepler and Galileo, yes, there was a new estimate of the size of the universe. It was a larger estimate, but people had always known it was a really big place, and just putting a few more zeros after a big number doesn't really have much of a cultural impact. It's still huge. So, and the early modern scientists who did add a few more zeros to our estimate of universe size, they were devout Christians for the most part, like the scientists that I mentioned. And they saw no problem whatsoever with the slightly increased estimate of the size of the universe compared to medieval times. And they thought it was completely consistent with the Christian faith. So it's a historical myth in that the largeness of the universe is not just a modern discovery. Pre-modern people knew that in the Western tradition. And it's also a myth that even today, as we look at, you know, how enormously big the universe is, it's always been consistent with Christianity. I mean, look, if an omnipotent God made a universe, wouldn't you expect it to be huge, not dinky?
Excellent point. Okay, Galileo was persecuted and prosecuted by the church. This is an example of the church being anti-science. This is constantly brought up. Comment on that, please.
Yeah, well, the Galileo affair was much more complicated than science versus religion. It was really two different groups of scientists that were competing. The majority of scientists thought the Earth was at rest, and at the time, the evidence was really in the favor of that view. Galileo tried to make a case for a moving Earth. He did a pretty good job, but it wasn't until a generation later, in the time of Newton, that was really settled science that the Earth does, in fact, move. So at the time of Galileo, it really was up for grabs which side was going to win. No one really knew, and Galileo had the knack of, actually the bad habit of mocking his opponents. And that got him in trouble with his own Catholic Church. And so, but there were still theologians even within the Catholic Church who supported Galileo, and there were a minority of scientists that supported him, but the vast majority of thinkers at the time realized that at that time, Galileo had exaggerated his case for removing Earth, and he just didn't show the evidence pointed that way. That came later. So today, what people do is they read the later evidence back in the past and say, oh, look, Galileo had the right answer, and the church was so stupid, did not see it. But at the time, it really wasn't clear. And so it was that's an anachronistic reading of history, and that's just bad history.
Would it be safe to say, too, that the church had bought into, at the time, the idea of a Ptolemaic view of the universe and imposed that on the Bible? Galileo proved that that was not accurate, so therefore the interpretation of the Bible was something that was inaccurate. But it wasn't the Bible itself, it was the interpretation. Is that fair?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. That's the case, Jerry. Particularly as we look back on it with hindsight, we know that the Earth does move the sun, around the sun. And the scriptural passages that talk about natural phenomena like the sun and the Earth, the Bible describes it using observational language, not theoretical language. And so, yeah, the Earth seems to be at rest. The sun seems to rise and set. And scientists today still use the terms sunrise and sunset without error,
yeah,
as did Copernicus.
Yeah.
So there's no biblical error there. And Galileo wrote about this, and he was actually very very perceptive about the theological issues, even though he wasn't a theologian. And he wrote a famous letter to the Grand Duchess Christina to explain this. It got him into a little bit of trouble with those who disagreed. But, eventually, even the Catholic Church recognized that Galileo was right on these matters.
Giordano Bruno is a name that we ought to know. He is often touted by humanists as a martyr for science. But, again, the facts of history are kind of distorted in this. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Bruno was an interesting philosopher who, unfortunately, was burned at the stake in the year 1600 by the Catholic Church, The Catholic Church was very defensive. It was during the Counter-Reformation, and so they tended to jump to conclusions. But Bruno was burnt, and again, that was a horrible thing to do. You should never burn someone for their ideas. So he is a martyr for free speech, but he really wasn't a martyr for science, because his belief in other worlds around other suns, other planets, where life might be, that was based more on his philosophy. There was no scientific evidence at the time that really showed that there truly is that there really are a universe that's that big. He thought it was infinitely big, and that God had to create the world infinitely big because that was the only way God could express His greatness. And he really diminished the role of Jesus as the embodiment of God's greatness, and thought the universe kind of took the role as the mediator between God and man. And so his philosophy and theology was heretical, and that's why he was burned. Again, bad idea to burn him, but he wasn't really a martyr for science, and that's the myth.
What country was he from?
Italy.
Italy, okay. You also have one of the myths, why the allegedly anti-science Christian Dark Ages never happened. Tell us about that. And by the way, whenever you hear that phrase, Dark Ages, this is my view, and I studied history at Tulane University. I have a BA in it, in fact, with honors, if I could say so. That's the first time I've ever said that. But anyway, bottom line is, the Dark Ages, if you will, the early parts of the medieval period happened because the barbarians overran what at the time was outwardly Christian Rome. And so then, out of the ashes of all this destruction and chaos, slowly the Latin Church built up order, where there was much chaos and so forth. And anyway, when I think of the phrase Dark Ages, and then you look at something like Notre Dame, which was made in the, the 1043 A.D. or something like that. I forget the exact year, the 11th century. And anyway, you think that was a product of the Dark Ages? I don't think so. But your comment on the Dark Ages, especially as it relates to Christianity and science.
Yeah. Yeah, I think your read on the general cultural and military facts are right. And, it took a while for a new civilization to arise out of all that chaos. But even during that chaos, Christians were preserving learning in the monasteries and in other venues. And then when the universities were invented, especially in the 12th century, you know, I mean, remember, universities are a Christian invention, and science took up about a third of the curriculum for undergraduates. So that was, you know, a spectacular cultural achievement motivated by a very rational and devotional view of God and how humans reflect God as image bearers. And so, yeah, a lot of interesting science came out of the Middle Ages, and some of Galileo's work actually kind of reinvented what was done earlier. He didn't have, complete connection with his past. He kind of, so that is a testimony to the medieval brilliance on certain points, like in optics and on the study of motion. And Galileo came up with similar conclusions and, of course, took it a lot further. But, yeah, they weren't truly dark ages. They were, I mean, the term Middle Ages is a more accurate term, middle between the ancient and the modern. It's a traditional term, but dark ages, really, serious scholars don't use that term.
Good. Yeah, especially when you look at some of the achievements of that. And, you know, by the way, just as a quick aside, you look at the writings of somebody like St. Anselm, Archbishop of Canterbury, again, I guess in the 11th century, and you just read his writings. Or you read the writings of Thomas Aquinas. I challenge any skeptic, read the writings of Thomas Aquinas. Any skeptic that thinks that Christianity is just for the dull of intellect. Okay, read the writings of Thomas Aquinas. Read the writings of C.S. Lewis. Read the writings of Blaise Pascal from the 1600s, C.S. Lewis from the 1900s. Hey, you know, tell me that these are, you know, dimwits. They're not. They're not. And in fact, I think if anything, what's happening is a lot of secularists today, like the people you mentioned, Neil deGrasse Tyson or Bill Nye the Science Guy, they just kind of recycle these myths and make it off as if it's common knowledge that Christianity is anti-science. But it's really not when you strip it all away.
Yeah, and one of my heroes of the story is Johannes Kepler, and that's the positive part of my book. He was a devout Christian and a scientist, and for him and for others like him, like Galileo, look, if there is a God who exists who is maximally rational, and that's the Christian view, then we should expect humanity to have confidence to discover mathematically elegant natural laws issued by that maximally rational lawgiver. And that's exactly what happened. Yeah. They understood that the book of nature was written in the language of mathematics, and this came from the mind of God. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, that is amazing. A rational God had created a rational universe, and it was up to them as scientists. Kepler even say that we as scientists are priests of the Most High God, and the goal was to think God's thoughts after him, to look at the, you know, laws that the Creator has impressed in his own universe and discover what those laws are and then foretell them to everybody else.
Yeah, in fact, the direct quote from the primary text that I use in my book is Kepler said that by rediscovering these mathematical principles that are in natural laws, we quote, share in his own thoughts, that is God's thoughts.
Wow.
And that's often paraphrased in the way that you did. It's thinking God's thoughts after him. That's the nugget of Kepler's theological insight that bore a lot of scientific fruit.
Okay, what about Isaac Newton? Wouldn't you say that of all scientists that have ever lived, perhaps Einstein was the best and then Newton would be second? But in any event, Newton was huge. Newton and God and the Bible, comment on that, if you would.
Yeah. In fact, although my first book doesn't get much into Newton, my second book, which I'm just now starting, starts with Newton and is going to end with Hawking, who had the same chair at Trinity College, Cambridge, as Newton did. But you're right, Newton was a giant of an intellect and a very devout follower of Christ. He had a minority viewpoint about the Trinity, but he did believe that the blood of Christ was the only basis for his salvation.
Mm.
So, and he was, his co-invention of the calculus with Leibniz, his work in basic physics and optics is just spectacular. He was probably the most intelligent Christian that ever lived.
Wow. Okay, we're out of time. We're out of time at this time, but I want to refer people to your book. I apologize about that. UnbelievableMyths.com, UnbelievableMyths.com by Dr. Michael Keyes, K-E-A-S. Thank you so much, Dr. Keyes.
Thank you, Jerry.